The green deck of the melon boat had been divided into a male and female section for the sake of decency. This meant that most of the deck was occupied by Mrs. Whitlow, who spent a lot of the time sunbathing behind a screen. Her privacy was assured by the wizards themselves, since at least three of them would probably kill any of the others who ventured within 10 feet of the palm leaves. There was definitely what Ponder's aunt, who'd raised him, would have called an atmosphere.
"I still think I ought to climb the mast," he protested.
"Eh? A peeping Tom, eh?" snarled the senior wrangler.
"No, I just think it would be a good idea to see where the boat is going," said Ponder. "There are some big black clouds ahead."
"Good. We could do with the rain," snapped the chair of indefinite studies.
"In which case, I shall be honoured to make Mrs. Whitlow a suitable shelter," said the dean.
Ponder walked back to the stern, where the arch-chancellor was gloomily fishing.
"Honestly, you'd think Mrs. Whitlow was the only woman in the world," he said.
"Do you think, she might be?" said Ridcully. Ponder's mind raced and hit some horrible speed bumps in his imagination.
"Surely not, sir."
"We don't know, Ponder. Still, look on the bright side. We may all be drowned."
Sir, have you looked at the horizon?"
The everlasting storm was 7,000 miles long, but only a mile wide. A great turning, boiling mass of enraged air circling the last continent like a family of foxes circling a henhouse. The clouds were mounted up all the way to the edge of the atmosphere, and they were ancient clouds now, clouds that had rolled around their tortured circuit for years, building up personality and hatred, and above all, voltage. It was not a storm, it was a battle. Mere gales, a few hundred miles long, fought amongst themselves within the cloud wall. Lightning forked from thunderhead to thunderhead. Rain fell and flashed into a stream half a mile from the ground. The air glowed. And below, emerging from the ocean of potentiality in a rainstorm so thunderous that it was no more than a descending sea, rose the last continent. On the wall of the deserted cell in Bugger-Up Jail, among the scratches and stick drawings and tallies of a man's last few days, a drawing of a sheep became a drawing of a kangaroo, and then faded completely into the stone.
"So," said the dean, "we're in for a bit of a blow."
The grey line filled the immediate future like a dental appointment.
"I think it might be a lot worse," said Ponder.
"Well, let's steer somewhere else, then."
"There's no rudder, sir, and we don't know where anywhere else is, and we're low on water anyway."
"Don't they say that a big bank of cloud means there's land ahead?" said the dean. "Bloody big land, then, XXXXX, don't you think?"
"I hope so, sir."
Above Ponder, the sail flapped and billowed.
"Wind's freshening, sir. I think the storm's sucking the air towards it. And there's something else, I think. I wish I hadn't left my thermometer on the beach, sir, because I think there's a very high level of background magic in this area."
"What makes you say this, boy?" said the dean.
"Well, for one thing, everyone seems to be getting a bit tense, and wizards tend to get touchy in the presence of large amounts of magic," said Ponder. "But my suspicions were first aroused when the Bursa developed planets."
There were two of them, orbiting his head at a height of a few inches. As was so often the case with magical phenomena, they possessed virtual unreality, and passed unscathed through him and one another. They were slightly transparent.
"Oh, dear. Mugroop's syndrome," said Ridcully. "Cerebral manifestation. Better than a canary down a coal mine, a sign like that."
A little sub-routine in Ponder's head began a short countdown.
"Remember old Dicky Bird?" said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "He..."
"Three. No, I don't, as a matter of fact. Do tell."
Ponder heard himself bark, louder than he would have done, even if he had meant to vocalize his thoughts.
"Indeed I shall, Mr. Stibbons," said the chair calmly. "He was very susceptible to high magical fields, and if his mind wandered, as it might do when he was dozing off, sometimes around his head there'd be these little..."
"Yes, certainly," said Ponder quickly. "We'll have to be very careful to keep an eye open for unusual behaviour."
"Among wizards?" said Ridcully. "Mr. Stibbons' unusual behaviour is perfectly ordinary for wizards."
"People acting out of character, then," Ponder shouted. talking sense for 2 minutes together, perhaps. Acting like normal civilized people instead of a herd of self-regarding village idiots.
Stibbons, it's not like you to take that tone, said Ridcully.
That's what I mean.
Now then, Mostrom, go easy on him. We're all under a lot of stress, said the Dean.
Now he's doing it, Ponder yelled, pointing a shaking finger. The Dean is normally never nice. Now he's being aggressively reasonable.
Historians have pointed out that it is in times of plenty that people feel like going to war. In times of famine, they're simply trying to find enough to eat. When they've just enough to go round, they tend to be polite. But when a banquet is spread before them, it's time to argue over the place settings. In fact, it's the view of the more thoughtful historians, particularly those who have spent time in the same bar as the theoretical physicists, that the entirety of human history can be considered as a sort of blooper reel. All those wars, all those famines, caused by malign stupidity, all that determined, mindless repetition of the same old errors, are in the great cosmic scheme of things only equivalent to Mr. Spock's ears falling off. And Unseen University, as even wizards realized it somewhere just below the top level of their minds, existed not to further magic, but in a very creative way to suppress it. The world had seen what happened when wizards got their hands on enormous amounts of magical power. It had happened a long time ago, and there were still some areas where you didn't go, if you wanted to walk out on the same kind of feet that you'd had when you went in. Once upon a time, the plural of wizard was war. But the great open, ingenious purpose of UU was to be the weight on the arm of magic, causing it to swing with grave majesty like a pendulum, rather than spin with deadly purpose like a morning star. Instead of hurling fireballs at one another from fortified towers, the wizards learned to snipe at their colleagues over the interpretation of faculty council minutes, and long ago were amazed to find that they got just as much vicious fun out of it. They consumed big dinners, and after a really good meal and a fine cigar, even the most rabid Dark Lord is inclined to put his feet up and feel amicable towards the world, especially if it's offering him another brandy. And slowly, and by degrees, they absorb the most important magical power of all, which is the one that persuades you to stop using all the others. The trouble is that it's easy to abstain from sweets when you're not standing knee-deep in treacle, and it's raining sugar.
There does indeed seem to be a certain tang in the air, said the lecturer in recent runes.
Magic tastes like tin.
Hold on a moment, said Ridcully. He reached up, pulled open one of the many drawers in his wizarding hat, and removed a cube of greenish glass. Here we are, he said, handing it to Ponder. Ponder took the thermometer and peered into it.
Never used it myself, Ridcully said. Wetting a finger and holding it up has always been good enough for me.
It's not working, said Ponder, tapping the thermometer as the ship rocked under them. The needles... Whoa!
He dropped the cube, which was molten by the time it hit the deck.
That's impossible, he said. These things are good up to 1,000,000 thaums.
Ridcully licked his finger and held it up. It sprouted a halo of purple and octarine.
Yep, that's about right, he said.
There's not that much magic anywhere anymore, shouted Ponder.
There was a gale behind the boat now. Ahead, the wall of storm was widening and seemed to be a lot blacker.
How much magic does it take to create a continent? Said Ridcully.
They looked up at the clouds, and further up.
We'd better batten down the hatches, said the Dean.
We don't have any hatches.
Batten down Mrs. Whitlow, at least. Get the bursar and the librarian somewhere safe.
They hit the storm. Rincewind dropped into an alley and reflected that he'd been in far worse prisons. The Axians were a friendly lot, when not drunk or trying to kill you, or both. What Rincewind looked for in a good jail were guards who, instead of ruining everyone's night by prowling around the corridors, got together in one room with a few tins and a pack of cards and relaxed. It made it so much more friendly. And, of course, easier to walk past. He turned, and there was the kangaroo, huge and bright and outlined against the sky. Rincewind shrank back for a moment, and then realized that it was nothing but an advertising sign on the roof of a building some way off and further down the hill. Someone had rigged up lamps and mirrors below it. It had a hat on, with some stupid holes for its ears to stick out, and it wore a vest as well. But it was certainly the kangaroo. No other kangaroo could possibly smirk like that, and it was holding a tin of beer.
"Where did you drift in from, Curly?"
said a voice behind him.
It was a very familiar voice. It had a sort of complaining wheedle in it. It was a voice that kept looking out of the corners of its eyes and was always ready to dodge. It was a voice you could have used to open a bottle of wine. He turned, and the figure in front of him, except for a few details, was as familiar as the voice.
"You can't be called Dibbler," said Rincewind.
"Why not?"
"Because, well, how did you get here?"
"What? I just came up Burke Street," said the figure.
It had a large hat and large shorts and large boots. But in every other respect, it was the double of the man who, in Ankh-Morpork, was always there after the pubs shut to sell you one of his very special meat pies. Rincewind had a theory that there was a Dibbler everywhere. Suspended from the neck of this one was a tray. On the front of the tray was written, "Dibbler's Café de Fete."
"I reckon I'd better get up to the jail early for a good pitch," said Dibbler. "Always gives the crowd an appetite, a good hanging. Can I interest you in anything, mate?"
Rincewind looked at the end of the alley. The streets were quite busy. As he watched, a couple of guards strolled by.
"Such as what?" he said suspiciously, drawing back into the shadows.
"Got some good broadsheet ballads about the notorious outlaw they're going to top."
"No, thank you."
"Souvenir piece of the rope they're going to hang him with? Authentic?"
Rincewind looked at the short length of thick string being dangled hopefully in front of him.
"Some people might say that had a hint of clothesline about it," he said.
Dibbler gave the string a look of extreme interest.
"Obviously we had to unravel it a bit, mate," he said.
"And some people might pick holes in the suggestion that you could, philosophically speaking, sell lengths of rope before the hanging."
Dibbler paused, his smile not moving. Then he said,
"It's the rope, right. 3/4-inch hemp, the usual stuff, authentic. Probably even from the same rope maker. Come on, all I'm looking for here is a fair go. Probably it's a pure fluke this ain't the actual bit that's going to go around his neck."
"That's only 1/2 inch thick. Look, I can see the label. It says Hill's Clothesline Co."
"Does it?"
Once again, Dibbler appeared to be looking at his product for the first time. But the traditions of the Dibbler clan would never let a mere disastrous fact get in the way of a spiel.
"It's still rope," he averred. "Authentic rope. Nah? No worries. How about some authentic native art?"
He rummaged in his crowded tray and held up a square of cardboard. Rincewind gave it an appraising look. He'd seen something like this out in the Red Country, although he'd not been certain that it was art in the way Ankh-Morpork understood it. It was more like a map, a history book, and a menu, all rolled together. Back home, people tied a knot in their handkerchief to remind them of things. Out in a hot country, there weren't any handkerchiefs, so people tied a knot in their thoughts. They didn't paint very many pictures of a string of sausages.
"It's called Sausage and Chips Dreaming," said Dibbler.
"I don't think I've seen one like that," said Rincewind. "Not with the sauce bottle in it as well."
"So what?" said Dibbler. "Still native. Genuine picture of traditional city tucker, done by a native. A fair go, that's all I ask."
"Oh, suddenly I think I understand. The native in this case, perhaps, being you," said Rincewind.
"Yep. Authentic. You arguing?"
"Oh, come on."
"What? I was born over there in Treacle Street, Bludgery, and so was me dad, and me granddad, and his dad. I just didn't step off the driftwood like some people I might mention."
His ratty little face darkened.
"Coming over here, taking our jobs. What about the little man, eh? All I'm asking for is a fair go."
For a moment, Rincewind contemplated handing himself over to the watch.
"Nice to hear someone siding with the rights of the indigenous population," he muttered, checking the street again.
"Indigenous? What do they know about a day's work? Nah, they can go back where they came from, too," said Dibbler. "They don't want to work."
"Good thing for you, though. I can see that," said Rincewind. "Otherwise, they'd be taking your job, right?"
"The way I see it, I'm more indigenous than them," said Fargo,
pointing an indignant thumb at himself.
"I earned my indigenuity, I did."
Rincewind sighed. Logic could take you only so far, then you had to get out and hop.
A fair go, that's what you want, he said. Am I right?
Yep.
So, is there anyone who you don't want to go back where they came from? Fair go, Dibbler gave this some deep consideration.
Well, me, obviously,
he said.
My mate Duncan, because Duncan's me mate. And Mrs. Dibbler, of course. And some of the blokes down at the fish and chip shop. Lots of people, really.
Well, I'll tell you what, said Rincewind. I definitely want to go back where I came from.
Good on ya.
Your socio-political analysis is certainly working on me.
Beaut.
And maybe you can show me how. Like, where the docks are.
Well, I would, said Dibbler, obviously torn. Only there's going to be this hanging in a few hours, and I want to get the meat pies warmed up.
As a matter of fact, I heard the hanging had been cancelled, said Rincewind, conspiratorially. The bloke escaped.
Never.
He certainly did, said Rincewind. I'm not pulling your raw prawn.
Did he have any last words?
Goodbye, I think.
You mean he wasn't in a famous last stand shootout with the watch?
Apparently not.
What kind of an escape is that? Said Fargo. That's no way to behave. I didn't have to come up here. I gave up a good spot at the Galah for this. It's not a good hanging without a meat pie.
He leaned closer and gave a furtive look both ways before continuing.
Say what you like. The Galah's good for business. Their money's the same as anyone else's. That's what I say.
Well, yes, obviously. Otherwise it'd be, different money, said Rincewind. So, since your night's ruined, why not just show me where the docks are? There was still some uncertainty in Dibbler's stance. Rincewind swallowed. He'd faced spiders, angry men with spears, and bears that dropped on you out of trees, but now the continent was presenting him with its most dangerous challenge. Tell you what, he said. I'll even buy something off you.
The rope?
Not the rope. Not the rope. I know this may seem a somewhat esoteric question, but, what's in the meat pies?
Meat.
And what kind of meat?
Ah, you want one of the gourmet meat pies, then?
Oh, I see. That's where you say what's in them.
Yep.
Before or after the customers have bitten into them?
Are you suggesting that my pies ain't right?
Let us say I'm inching my way to the possibility that they might be, shall we? All right. I'll try a gourmet pie.
Good on you.
Dibbler removed a pie from the little heated section of his tray. Now, what's the meat? Cat?
Do you mind? Mutton's cheaper than cat,
said Dibbler, upending the pie into a dish. Well, that's... Rincewind's face screwed up. Oh, no, you're pouring pea soup all over it, too. Why does everyone always pour pea soup over it?
No worries, mate. Put a lining in your stomach,
said Dibbler, producing a red bottle. And what's that?
The cut de grass, mate.
You are tipping a meat pie into a dish of pea soup, and now you want me to eat it... with tomato sauce on it?
Pretty colours, ain't they?
Said Fargo, handing Rincewind a spoon. Rincewind prodded the pie. It rebounded gently off the side of the dish. Well, now he'd eaten cut-me-own-throat Dibbler's sausage in a bun, and disembowel myself honourably Dibhala's funny-coloured antique eggs, and he'd survived, although there had been a few minutes when he'd hoped he wouldn't. He'd eaten Al Jibbler's highly suspicious couscous, drunk the terrible yak butter tea made by may-I-never-achieve-enlightenment Diblang, forced down the topless, bottomless smorgasbord of Dib Diblonsons, and tried not to chew the lumps of unmentionable blubber purveyed by may-I-be-kicked-in-my-own-ice-hole Dibuki. His stomach heaved at the memory of that. After all, it was one thing to butcher dead beached whales, and quite another just to leave them there until they exploded into bite-sized chunks of their own accord. As for the green beer made by swallow-me-own-blow-dart-delang-delang, he'd drunk
and eaten all these things. Everywhere in the world, someone turned up out of some strange primal mould to sell him a really dreadful regional delicacy. And this was just a pie, after all. How bad could it be? No, put it another way. How much worse could it be? He swallowed a mouthful.
Good, eh?
Said Fairgo.
My gods, said Rincewind.
They're not just any mushy peas,
said Fairgo, slightly disconcerted by the fact that Rincewind was staring wildly at nothing.
They're mushed by a champion pea musher.
Good grief, said Rincewind.
You're right, mister.
It's everything I expected, said Rincewind.
Nah, mister, it ain't that bad.
You're certainly a dibbler.
What kind of a thing is that to say?
You put pies upside down in runny peas and then put sauce on them. Someone actually sat down one day after midnight, if I'm any judge, and thought that would be a good idea. No one will ever believe this one. Rincewind looked at the submerged pie. That's going to make the story about the land of the giant walking plum puddings look very tame, I don't mind telling you. No wonder you people drink so much beer. There is such a thing as an edible, nay, delicious meat pie floater. Its mushy peas of just the right consistency, its tomato sauce piquant in its cheekiness, its pie filling tending even towards named parts of the animal. There are platonic burgers made of beef instead of cow lips and hooves. There are fish and chips, where the fish is more than just a white goo, lurking at the bottom of a batter casing and you can't use the chips to shave with. There are hot dog fillings, which have more in common with meat than with mere pinkness, whose lucky consumers don't apply mustard because that would spoil the taste. It's just that people can be trained to prefer the other sort and seek it out. It's as if Machiavelli had written a cookery book. Even so, there is no excuse for putting pineapple on pizza. He stepped out into the flickering lamplight of the street, shaking his head. You actually eat the pies here, he said mournfully, and looked up into the face of the warder. There were several watchmen behind him.
That's him!
Rincewind nodded cheerfully.
Good day,
he said. Two little thuds were his homemade sandals bouncing on the street. The sea steamed, and crackling balls of lightning zipped across its surface like drops of water on a hot plate. The waves were too big to be waves, but about the right size for mountains. Ponder looked up from the deck only once, just as the boat began to slide down a trough that gaped like a canyon. Next to him, and gripping his leg, the Dean groaned.
"You know about this sort of thing, Ponder," he growled as they hit the trough, and then began the stomach-twisting climb to the next crest. "Are we going to die?"
"I don't think so, Dean."
"Pity."
Rincewind heard whistles blowing behind him by the time he reached the corner, but he never let that sort of thing worry him. This was a city. Cities were so much easier. He was a creature of cities. There were so many places to... Whistles started blowing up ahead as well. The crowds were thicker here, and most people were heading in the same direction. But Rincewind liked crowds to run through. As they pursued, he had novelty on his side and could shoulder his way past the unsuspecting, who then turned around and milled about and complained and were definitely not in the right frame of mind to greet the people following him. Rincewind could run through a crowd like a ball on a bagatelle board and always got an extra go. Downhill was best. That's where they generally put docks, so as to have them closer to the water. Dodging and ducking across the streets brought him suddenly to the waterside. There were a few boats there. They were on the small side for a stowaway, but there were running footsteps in the dark. These watchmen were too good. This wasn't how it was supposed to go. They weren't supposed to double back. They weren't supposed to think. He ran in the only direction left, along the waterfront. There was a building there. At least it, well, it had to be a building. No one could have left an open box of tissues that big. Rincewind felt that a building should be a box with a pointed lid on it, basically, and it should be the approximate colour of whatever the local mud was. On the other hand, as the philosopher Lee Tin Weedle once remarked, it is never wise to object to the decor of a hidey-hole. He bounded up the steps and circled around the strange white building.
It seemed to be some kind of music hall. Opera, by the sound of it, although it was a damn funny place to sing opera. You couldn't imagine ladies with horns in a building that looked about to set sail. But no time to wonder about that. There was a door with some rubbish bins outside it, and here was the door open.
"You from the agency, mate?"
Rincewind peered into the steam.
"And I hope you can do puddings, because Sheffy's banging his head on the wall."
Went on a figure emerging from the wisps. It was wearing a tall white hat. "No worries," said Rincewind, hopefully. "Ah, this is a kitchen, is it?"
"You pulling my leg?"
"Only I thought it was some kind of opera house or something."
"Best bloody opera house in the world, mate. Come on this way."
It wasn't a very big kitchen, and like most of the ones Rincewind had been in, it was full of men working very hard at cross-purposes.
"The boss upstairs only decided to throw a big dinner for the prima donna," said the cook, forcing his way through the throng, "and all of a sudden Charlie sees the pudding staring at him in the face."
"Ah, right," said Rincewind, on the basis that sooner or later he'd be given a clue.
"Boss says you can do the pudding for her, Charlie."
"Just like that, eh?
He says it ought to be the best one yet, Charlie."
"No worries.
He says the great Nunco invented a strawberry Sackville for Dame Wendy Sackville, and the famous chef Impovo created the apple glazier for Dame Margarine Glazier, and your own father, Charlie, honoured Dame Janine Ormolu with the orange Ormolu, and tonight, Charlie, it's your big chance."
The cook shook his head as he reached a table where a small man in a white uniform was sobbing uncontrollably into his hands. There was a stack of empty beer cans in front of him.
"Poor bastard's been on the beer ever since, and we thought we'd better get someone in. I'm a steak and prawns man myself."
"So, you want me to make a pudding named after an opera singer," said Rincewind. "That's the tradition, is it?"
"Yeah, and you'd better not let Charlie down, mate. It's not his fault."
"Oh, well,"
Rincewind thought about puddings. Basically, it was just fruit and cream and custard, wasn't it? And cakes and stuff. He couldn't see where the problem lay.
"No worries," he said. "I think I can knock up something right away."
The kitchen became silent as the scurrying cooks stopped to watch him.
"First," said Rincewind, "what fruit have we got?"
"Peaches was all we could find at this time of night."
"No worries. And we've got some cream?"
"Yep, of course."
"Fine, fine. Then all I need to know is the name of the lady in question."
He felt the silence open up.
"She's a beaut singer, mind you," said a cook in a defensive tone of voice.
"Good. And her name?" said Rincewind.
That's the trouble, see," said another cook.
"Why?"
¶¶